LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hey, folks. Welcome to First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast for the Labor Relations Information System in Portland, Oregon. My name's Will Acheson, and I'll be spending the next, about hour or so with you, covering things that have occurred in the last 30 to 45 days that have some implications for the public safety workplace. First thing up, though, is not something that has happened. It's something that has yet to happen. And that is the Supreme Court's decision in the case known as Harris versus Quinn. This is the Fair Share case. What's going on in that case? This is a case that involves some Illinois home health care workers who objected to paying fair share assessments. They chose not to be union members, which was their right under Illinois law. But the union, which was the Service Employees International Union, as was its right under the law, assessed each of the non-members their fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering the contract. The workers objected and said, look, by forcing us to make payments to the union, you are in essence trampling on our First Amendment rights of free association. You are forcing us to financially support a group, and that you cannot do under the First Amendment. Now, the Supreme Court had long ago resolved this issue and resolved it in favor of unions, saying, look, you're not forcing anybody to join anything. What you're doing is forcing non-members to pay an amount of money that the union is actually spending on their behalf, negotiating the contract that covers them and perhaps even taking grievances on their behalf, even though they're not members. Supreme Court has long ago decided that case. So it was somewhat of a surprise when in 2013 we saw the court take up this challenge to the constitutionality of fair share. Who's behind the challenge? Well, that's pretty easy to see. The case is being brought by an outfit known as the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. This is the Virginia outfit. It's a nonprofit, a 501c3 corporation, that is behind most of the challenges that you see that get anywhere, challenges to union dues or fair share. Who or what is behind the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation? Well, it itself is an arm of an outfit known as the National Right to Work Committee, which is a 501c4 organization. Who's behind the National Right to Work Committee? Well, pretty easy to see. In 2012, an outfit named Freedom Partners, and that is an outfit that is funded by the Koch brothers, funneled $1 million in contributions to the National Right to Work Committee. And the Kochs have been very significant donors to the committee for years and years and years. There are other groups that or individuals that are less influential, but they're very much along the same lines in terms of their political thought. These are folks who are extremely conservative. They tend to style themselves almost as libertarians, although you might question whether or not they really are libertarian or whether they are just kind of radical right-wingers. The other groups that support the committee include the Walton Family Foundation. When you think Walton Family Foundation, think Walmart. And you can, of course, understand why the Walton family would not be particularly interested in unions having adequate financial foundations. Also, the Coors family. The Coors family has long been involved in anti-union efforts. So what this case does is to pit these very conservative groups against national unions, and in this case, one of the biggest national unions, the Service Employees International Union. Oral argument in the case was had in, I think it was January of this year, and there were very strange reports from the oral argument. Strange reports in this fashion. There are five justices on the Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court, five justices who are very reliable in terms of ruling for employers and against labor organizations. My count has been that over the last 11 years or so, there have been 44 cases that the Supreme Court has decided that have pitted management against labor, either management against a union or management against an individual employee. The results, and I concede that people can count a little bit differently than I do on this, but my count of the results is that management has won 41 of those 44 cases. Labor has won one, and there have been two that I think you could say both sides came away with something. So the record, 41, 1, and 2 in favor of management, that's not an accident. That is a philosophy that is being expressed by this five-judge majority on the court. And you see that five-judge majority, of course, pop up in a lot of different ways. It's roughly the same five-judge majority that has driven a number of the court's more controversial rulings in the last few years. What was surprising about the oral argument is that the one of those five justices, who is perhaps the most conservative justice on the court, Antonin Scalia, seemed to be on the side of fair share being legal in the oral argument. Justice Scalia doesn't hesitate to comment from the bench when he's hearing an oral argument. Some justices, for example, Justice Clarence Thomas, never say anything. Scalia's at the other end of the scale, and his comments were pretty strongly suggestive that he understood what unions characterize as the free rider issue, the notion that if someone is not a member of the union, their presence in the bargaining unit still means the union has a duty of fair representation to them. And in essence, they are getting services, the services that are encompassed within that duty of fair representation, contract bargaining, grievance representation, and the like. They are getting services for free, and the union is having to expend funds on behalf of those members. It would be a very unusual event if, when this case came down, we saw fair share continue to be legal, and the swing vote being that of Justice Scalia. We've all been anticipating this case would have come down before now. There were cases that were argued before Harris versus Quinn that the Supreme Court has already issued opinions on. Usually, a delay in issuing an opinion means that there's going to be one or more dissenting opinions that are going to be very long. Usually it means something like that, or it can even mean that the court is having difficulty coming up with a majority vote for any one particular position. But in any case, it is almost certain that the decision will be handed down before the end of the Supreme Court's term, and that means before the end of June. Usually, the court releases its opinions on Mondays, although when it gets to the end of the term, it tends to release them whenever it wants. But at a minimum, check your inboxes on Monday, and you'll see whether or not fair share continues to be legal in this country. What happens if the court rules against fair share? What it means is that for public sector employees, the entire country will become right to work. There will be no right to make these fair share assessments anywhere in the country, and employees will have to voluntarily join unions, and if they don't, they still will get the benefits of the union's efforts negotiating contracts that cover them. On the union side, folks think this is quite dire. I'm looking right now at a headline from Mother Jones magazine, which is a liberal magazine, and the headline says, "Will the Supreme Court kill public employee unions?" Well, I don't think it's that it would go that far, an adverse ruling would go that far. It would definitely require unions to do a lot more in the way of internal organizing than they have done in the past. But would it be a blow? No question. It'd be a serious blow. We've gone several months now without hearing much in the way of legal developments or workplace developments from California, and then boom, all of a sudden, in this month, we have three cases that I think are just very well done by the courts or labor board that issued them, and I think they stand for propositions that generally apply all over the country. The first one, I think, may have a little bit more California impact than it would have elsewhere, but there's a bunch of principles in this case that I think that bear repeating for all of us. This is a case involving Contra Costa County, which is a county up in the Bay Area, and it involves a recent amendment to one of California's collective bargaining laws. California has several public sector collective bargaining laws. The main one, the one that covers cities and counties, is known as the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, or MMBA. It's been around a long time. Myers-Milius-Brown calls for a meet-and-confer process for bargaining. At the end of the meet-and-confer process, the employer is allowed to unilaterally implement its last best offer. This is sort of an exception to the normal rule with public sector and public safety employees around the country. Usually, public safety collective bargaining laws end with binding arbitration. They don't end with the employer being able to unilaterally implement its last best offer. However, that's the model that's followed in California. It's followed elsewhere. Florida, I think most notably, it is followed. Well, what happened here is that in 2011, the California legislature amended the Myers-Milius-Brown Act to require non-binding fact-finding in the bargaining process. The California Supreme Court had earlier ruled that binding arbitration is the last step of the bargaining process, violated a sort of unique clause in the California Constitution. So binding arbitration was not on the table. What the legislature did was to graft onto the law a non-binding fact-finding process. Fact-finding looks and acts an awful lot like arbitration. A neutral third party is appointed to consider the dispute, considers things like comparable jurisdictions and the cost of living and the employer's ability to pay, workload, productivity, you know, all of those factors that you would normally consider in binding arbitration. Only at the end, the fact-finder's decision isn't binding. It serves solely as a recommendation. And if either side rejects the recommendation, then you're right back at the end of the process, which is unilateral implementation. So the question that in this case is brewing in a couple of different forums in California is whether fact-finding only applies to negotiations for a new contract. And in California, most contracts are referred to as memoranda of understanding or MOUs. You may hear me use that phrase. Whether or not fact-finding only applies to negotiations for a new MOU or instead applies to all collective bargaining disputes. Well, what other types of collective bargaining are there other than negotiations for a new MOU? Midterm bargaining. Bargaining where the employer wants to make a change in a past practice, in a policy or procedure, and that past practice or policy or procedure is mandatory for bargaining, and the underlying contract doesn't give the employer the authority to make the change. So, for example, let's say the employer decides we want to have a residency rule. All employees from now on have to live within the city. Likely as not, the contract doesn't cover that. Is residency a mandatory subject of bargaining? Sure. Courts, labor boards across the country have held that residency is a mandatory subject of bargaining. What midterm bargaining means is before the employer makes a change in that residency rule, it would have to negotiate with the union. And the question in California that's brewing is, for this type of midterm bargaining where the employer wants to change past practices, does the employer have to submit to the fact-finding process? Now, the first place this dispute erupted was in 2013 in a trial court down in Riverside County, where the trial court held that the legislature did not intend to graft fact-finding onto the midterm bargaining process. California's Public Employment Relations Board, which administers the law, promptly filed an appeal in that case, and that stayed the trial court's ruling. Then this Contra Costa County case comes up, and it goes directly to PERB. It doesn't go to court. And PERB gets to issue an opinion, its own opinion, as to what it thinks the law it is charged with administering means. In other words, is it going to agree with the court in Riverside County that fact-finding doesn't apply in midterm bargaining, or is it going to strike off on its own? And the answer is the board, PERB, strikes off on its own. PERB, it's almost like a slap across the face at the trial court. PERB found that it was very clear that fact-finding applied to midterm bargaining. I'm going to read you a little bit of what PERB had to say here. First of all, it said, look, we have to look at the purpose of what impasse resolution procedures are. And the purpose, PERB says, is to bring resolution to bargaining disputes with the assistance of a neutral third party. And that's a good thing, because what it does is to allow the parties to explore all avenues to a peaceful settlement of the bargaining dispute. And fact-finding assists that, because what it does is to provide both sides with additional information so that they can make more knowledgeable decisions as to where they are with respect to bargaining. Here's the sentence that I think that is the key sentence in PERB's opinion. Meet and confer means that a public agency and representatives of a employee organization shall meet and confer promptly in order to freely exchange information, opinions, and proposals, and to endeavor to reach an agreement on matters within the scope of bargaining. The duty to meet and confer in good faith applies not only to negotiations for new or successor MOUs, but also to midterm negotiations, where the public agency seeks to make changes in negotiable subjects. PERB says fact-finding is an effective tool. It improves labor relations, and we think the legislature meant to apply it to midterm bargaining. Well, we haven't heard the last word on this, have we? We have that Riverside County case that's being appealed through the court system. Probably Contra Costa County is going to appeal the PERB's decision into the court system, and we're going to end up with a decision from the California Court of Appeals, or perhaps, just perhaps, and this may be significant enough that I think you can even predict this, a decision from the California Supreme Court as to whether or not there is fact-finding for midterm bargaining. This is a dispute that probably won't end for another 2 to 3 years. Our next case, this second California case I wanted to talk about, is as good an explanation of how the ADA and the FMLA, the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Family and Medical Leave Act, interact in the fitness for duty process, as good an explanation as I've ever seen from any court. This is a case that involves a woman by the name of Susan White, who works for the District Attorney's Office in Los Angeles County. She's an investigator there. It's a sworn law enforcement officer's job, and she does things such as serve arrest warrants, makes arrests, interrogates suspects, books prisoners, and does all sorts of various and sundry law enforcement duties. In about 2009, White's brother-in-law died, and she began experiencing some pretty serious emotional difficulties. She started acting erratically in the workplace and was demonstrating very high emotional highs at times and very low lows. She began making some unsafe tactical decisions, complained to her supervisor that she was having trouble regulating her medications. She was seen in the workplace crying, behaving anxiously, having dramatic mood swings. And then there came in 2010 kind of a fateful tactical training session. And during this session, White did all sorts of things wrong. She tripped over a fellow investigator. She was continuously pointing her weapon. It was a dummy weapon, but nonetheless, she was pointing it at other team members. And in a follow-up conversation with her supervisor about, you know, what in the world is going on here, White described herself as a whack job and also said that she'd recently completely lost her composure on the witness stand. White took FMLA leave. Completely appropriate, right? I mean, these sorts of emotional conditions clearly are serious health conditions under the FMLA. She took FMLA leave and got treatment for her psychological conditions and eventually shows up back at work with a full release from her doctor. The employer says, well, wait a minute here. What we want to do is we want to put you on administrative leave with pay because we want you to go through a fitness for duty evaluation before you come back to work. And White's response is to sue and say, look, under the FMLA, when I present a doctor's note certifying that I no longer have a serious health condition and I can do the essential functions of the job, that's the end of it. You don't have a right to a second opinion, employer. That's the way the return to work process works under the FMLA. And that's the dispute that makes it up to the California Court of Appeals. And the court starts off by saying, White, you're right. Of course, it doesn't end up that way, but it starts off that way. The court says there is no right under the FMLA for an employer to get a second opinion when the employee is returning to work from an FMLA qualifying condition and has a certification from his or her doctor. The court goes through a pretty long analysis of the FMLA and its regulations and says, look, it's pretty clear. Where normally, if someone's going to use FMLA leave and the employer has reason to question whether or not the employee qualifies under the FMLA, normally the employer does have the right to a second opinion. The employer doesn't have a right to a second opinion when the employee is already on FMLA leave and is trying to return to work. But that's not the end of the issue, says the court, because this is where the Americans with Disabilities Act comes into play. And the court says, without regard to the FMLA, an employer has the right to compel an employee to go through a fitness for duty evaluation if, and here's the standard, if it has reasons that are job related and consistent with business necessity. And that means, says the court, if a reasonable employer would conclude that this employee can't do the essential functions of the job. And here, says the court, we think, a reasonable employer, anybody, would conclude that the district attorney's office had a reasonable basis to question whether or not White could do the job. The court says, look, you know, what we're looking for here is answers to these sorts of questions. White had severe depression before she left. That depression caused her to put her own safety into danger, the safety of others into danger. It manifested itself with White's inability to react properly in tactical situations and caused her to give unprofessional and possibly false testimony in a criminal case. White says, well, wait a minute. That all happened before I left for FMLA leave. How can you order a fitness for duty evaluation now? And the court's answer is, simply because these events happened before the FMLA leave started doesn't mean they're off limits for an employer in the decision-making process under the ADA as to whether or not the employee can be forced to go through a fitness for duty evaluation. The question rather is, were these events close enough in time that a reasonable employer would think there was a risk of putting a, in this case, police officer back on the job? And the court said, yeah, these are close. We're not talking about stuff that happened years ago. We're talking about stuff that happened months ago. And a reasonable employer would want to make sure that this employee is fit for duty. And so what is the bottom line of what happens in White's case? She loses. And the reason she loses is because when she came back from FMLA leave, the county very carefully put her on administrative leave with pay, pending the fitness for duty evaluation. In other words, it effectively reinstated her under the FMLA, which is what its obligation was to do, and took advantage of its rights under the ADA to compel the fitness for duty evaluation. Great opinion describing how these two federal statutes that roughly deal with disabilities interact in the context of a fitness for duty evaluation. And I've just summarized what is a pretty long opinion here. If you're in the business of dealing with these fitness for duty evaluations, I'd strongly recommend you take a look at that opinion. Our third California case this month is one that serves as a reminder, I think, to employers everywhere, and that is most states, maybe even all, where there's collective bargaining, will recognize a union privilege, a privilege where union officials can meet with union members and talk over matters within the scope of representation without the employer later being able to inquire as to what those conversations were. This is a case that involves the Merced County Sheriff's Employees Association and Merced County. Merced County is in the Central Valley of California. This is a corrections case, and it all gets started with an incident that occurs in the main jail yard where several inmates from the main jail attacked another inmate. Almost immediately after that, there was a meeting of the executive board of the Sheriff's Employees Association, and the executive board's lawyer, a fellow named Barry Bennett, was present. And at the meeting, they talk about the attack in the main jail, main jail yard. And the question that the executive board is debating is, do we, corrections officers, have adequate non-lethal weapons? Because there's a possibility that we could have intervened in this fight without putting as much danger on our shoulders and on the shoulders of the inmates as well, had we had additional non-lethal weapons. In particular, they're concerned about a non-lethal weapon that's known as a pepper ball launcher, which is a forced compliance weapon that launches a projectile which breaks on impact and releases a chemical irritant. Well, once they're through talking about it at the meeting, Bennett, the lawyer, puts the concerns in a letter and sends the letter to the sheriff. Very quickly, a commander begins an investigation. The sheriff tells the commander to start an investigation and looks into the safety issues that are raised in the letter. And the commander looks at video footage of the incident and makes the judgment that a pepper ball launcher probably wouldn't have been all that effective in stopping the fight. The commander then assigns an investigator who meets with the association president, a fellow by the name of Frank Mello, to discuss the issue. In the course of the questioning, the investigator asked Mello who told him there had been a fight in the yard. The answer is important. I'm going to quote it. It's very brief. The answer is important in the context of this case. Mello's answer is, we discussed it among ourselves. The investigator again asked Mello, who told you there was a fight in the yard? Mello asked the investigator, am I being ordered to tell you? Are you ordering me to tell you who told us about the fight in the yard? The investigator says, yes, you're being ordered. Mello identifies the officer, and the investigator says, that's your problem right there. Apparently didn't think much of the corrections officer who reported it. That exchange had a pretty profound impact on Mello. He goes to the association and says, look, I want to resign as union president because I think I'm going to end up getting fired and I don't want another confrontation with management. The association's board convinces Mello not to resign before his term expires, and the board also authorizes the association to file an unfair labor practice complaint against the county. And the essence of the unfair labor practice complaint is the county was inquiring into privileged information by asking Mello to reveal his source. This ends up getting decided by California's Public Employment Relations Board, same outfit I talked about in the last segment. And what the board focuses on here is, would the investigator have had any reason to know that he was inquiring into a protected communication? I mean, after all, what Mello said was, we discussed it among ourselves. He didn't say, I learned about that in a union meeting. He didn't say, I learned about that in the course of my representation of an employee. All he said was, we discussed it among ourselves. And California's PERB said that should have put the investigator on notice that he was inquiring into protected materials. Here's the quote. Such response was coupled with statements from the complaining employee that he met with association members to address these concerns. These two together established to a reasonable person that the discussion occurred among association representatives. Therefore, when the investigator ordered Mello to answer his question after a second inquiry, he was now inquiring into the internal discussions of the association. And that sort of inquiry, says the board, causes at least slight harm to employee rights as it tends to chill association representatives in their discussions with their legal representatives. Well, legal representatives, because Bennett was in the room, right? There might be some attorney-client privilege implications there. What if it's just an executive board meeting and there's no lawyer in the room? Well, the board thought of that as well. The board says, look, reporting safety concerns to a union is protected activity. Therefore, whether the complaining employee told Mello or any other safety employee about his concerns prior to the executive board meeting doesn't change our conclusion about the investigator's dogged inquiry into the identity of the reporter. The harm here is not simply seeking to learn what transpired at a union meeting and is not dependent upon whether an attorney was present. The harm lies in the potential chilling effect the employer's conduct could have on employees' discussions with their representatives in the future. Again, as I started off this discussion, I think this case really is a reminder more than anything else, a reminder to employers. Usually, of course, employers respect the confidentiality of the union and union member discussions. In fact, I've dealt with many, many employers who actually think they gain a benefit out of making sure that union and union member discussions are freewheeling and that union members feel that they can say everything to their union. Employers think, you know, that's great. That allows us to have better discussions with the union and even with our own employees. But every once in a while, you'll see a case where an employer is trying to get into privileged information. There was a decision last year from the Alaska Supreme Court on precisely this issue, and courts and labor boards are pretty strict. If this is a discussion that happens at a board meeting, if this is a discussion that happens in a one-on-one setting between a union representative and a member, it's off limits to the employer. While I'm talking about union rights, let's go north of California a little bit and visit the state of Washington, and in particular the Washington State Patrol Troopers Association, for a case that involves a interesting question. You don't see it litigated much, but you sure see it argued about quite a bit. Does a union have a right to conduct a parallel disciplinary investigation? In other words, while the employer is doing an investigation, does the union have the right to be out there doing its own investigation at the same time? This is a case that involves the Washington State Patrol. Rank and file troopers and sergeants in WSP are represented by the Washington State Patrol Troopers Association, and a fellow by the name of Spike Unruh is an executive board member. There's a potential disciplinary investigation into one of the WSPTA's members, and Unruh gets assigned to represent the member. And one of the first things Unruh does is to call three bargaining unit employees who were potential witnesses in the investigation, and he told the employees what he was doing. I'm representing the accused officer, and asked what they had seen. Eventually, Unruh talks to a captain about the issue, and the captain then promptly reports Unruh to WSP's Office of Professional Services. That's the equivalent of IA and WSP. And very quickly, the captain tells Unruh, you may not talk to witnesses. The association immediately stops the investigation. The vice president of the association, a fellow named Mark Soper, talks with management, and management says, look, you have no right to conduct parallel investigations. The email sent by the employer is very explicit on it. It says the appropriate timing for the association to interview or contact witnesses is after we make our initial finding in the case. The association challenges that, files an unfair labor practice complaint, says, hey, you are interfering with the internal activities of the association and you're hindering our ability to represent our members. And Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission agrees with the union. The commission says, look, engaging in an investigation of issues related to potential discipline, that's protected union activity under the law. And it says, look, it may even be helpful to the employer. And I'm quoting here, when a union investigation may be helpful in resolving matters before discipline even issues, that conduct is protected. And in this case, the union's representative's pre-disciplinary investigation into non-criminal employee misconduct was taken on behalf of the union. The key, says the commission, is that there's no showing by the patrol that the union investigation in any way impaired either the credibility or effectiveness of the employer's own investigation. There was no showing that the union engaged in coercive activities, no showing that somehow what the union was doing made it more difficult for the employer to complete its own investigation. And the commission ends up concluding that, look, a reasonable employee could perceive the employer's direction not to conduct a parallel investigation as a threat of reprisal and reprisal based on union activity. And thus, the direction to the union representative not to investigate employee misconduct interfered with protected employee rights. Again, you don't see this issue litigated very much, but where I've seen it, the result has been very much the same as this. You look at the nature of what it is the union is doing, and if all the union is doing is conducting a professional parallel investigation, professional in the sense that it has absolutely no impact on the employer, other than that the employer doesn't like it. It has no practical impact on the employer's ability to conduct its own investigation. That's going to be held to be a protected right, a right to conduct that parallel investigation. Okay, let's talk about sex for a while. Well, not really. That would be 1,001 other podcasts, but let's talk about a arbitrator's decision involving sexual misconduct and whether or not the arbitrator's opinion should be upheld against a challenge filed by the employer. This is yet another one in this series of cases we're seeing around the country where employers are challenging arbitrator decisions, reinstating employees, challenging those decisions on the theory that the decisions violate public policy. And there is an exception to the notion that arbitration is final and binding. There is a public policy exception. The scope of that exception, what I'll talk about in the context of describing this case. It's a pretty narrow exception, as you'll see. This case comes from Alaska, and it starts in 2009, when we have a 24-year-old Alaska state trooper. He's not referred to, in fact, none of the main actors here are referred to by name in the court's opinion. That's actually pretty common in disciplinary arbitrations where you see the identity of the innocent and the not-so-innocent protected. Usually they're referred to by their initials or by titles. In this case, we only know that this 24-year-old trooper is called the grievant. And the grievant responds as a backup one night. This call occurs late at night to a domestic abuse call. It's a husband and wife. The victim is the wife, and she's identified only as MH. By the time the grievant gets there, he assists in restraining MH's husband, who was clearly intoxicated and physically aggressive. The primary trooper who's on the scene takes over once they get the husband in custody. The primary trooper takes over kind of processing the scene for a while. He interviews MH and, you know, does a preliminary search of the residence. And then he goes to interview MH's daughter in another part of the house. And he says to the grievant, "Look, while I'm going and talking to daughter, I want you to present the MH with a pamphlet." I mean, it's a pamphlet that's given out in domestic abuse cases, and it's a pamphlet that describes victims' rights and particularly the rights of victims in domestic violence cases and the like. And it's standard practice for law enforcement officers to review this pamphlet with the victims of domestic abuse. MH and the grievant later say that during this pamphlet review, MH was kind of relentlessly flirting with the grievant. And at one point she asks him for his personal cell phone number, but he refuses. Eventually they clear the call, husband goes to jail, all that sort of stuff. And then the grievant goes home. He sleeps for a few hours, maybe kind of sort of should have slept for more, but he sleeps for a few hours. He wakes up early in the morning and thinks, okay, I'm off duty now. He gets MH's cell phone number from his notebook, his trooper notebook. He sends a text message to her cell phone, and tells her that, look, now that I'm off duty, I can give you my personal phone number. MH calls the grievant. They talk for a little while, and within hours, and I mean he gets to replace at 6 a.m., they are having consensual sex. The state finds out about this and fires the trooper. The trooper's labor organization, known as the Public Safety Employees Association, challenges that termination in arbitration, and an arbitrator finds that while it's not contested that the grievant engaged in unprofessional conduct and showed poor judgment, she also thinks that the termination is an inappropriate punishment. The arbitrator in particular points to prior instances of sexual misconduct on the part of other employees that had not resulted in termination. The arbitrator holds that just cause requires consistent disciplinary action, and that the state had an obligation to inform troopers if its policy had shifted to a zero-tolerance policy. And finally, the arbitrator concludes that the grievance conduct didn't rise to the level of hugely egregious behavior and that the grievant should be given the opportunity for rehabilitation. So she reverses the discharge and orders that the grievant be reinstated with full back pay, less a 3-day suspension. Pretty light suspension, lighter than you'd expect to see in a lot of these cases. The state, however, isn't happy at all and files a challenge with the Alaska Supreme Court saying, hey, this arbitrator's decision violates public policy. What's public policy? Public policy is law enforcement officers shouldn't be having sex with victims of crime within about 12 hours after responding to the call where you've met the victim for crime, victim of the crime. And the court, in a 3-2 decision with pretty vociferous dissent, says public policy doctrine doesn't apply to this arbitrator's decision. We're upholding the decision. Why? The court says the public policy exception to the finality of arbitrator's awards is a narrow one. To begin with, the public policy has to be, and I'm quoting, explicit, well-defined, and dominant. And it has to be ascertained by reference to the laws and legal precedents and not from general considerations of supposed public interest. That, by the way, is the Alaska Supreme Court stealing language from a U.S. Supreme Court decision, or series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions. The court goes on to say that courts, you know, you have to be careful as courts to approach with caution requests to further divine public policy in a field where other political branches have already created a regulatory regimen. And in this case, the court says, the question isn't whether or not the grievance conduct violated public policy. We all know his conduct was terrible. But that's not the question in these cases. The question is, does the arbitrator's order of reinstatement violate public policy? Or as phrased by this court, whether a decision to use progressive discipline and continue the employment of a trooper who's engaged in this type of sexual misconduct is in violation of an explicit, well-defined, and dominant public policy. In other words, is there a public policy against termination? And the court says, no, there isn't. We don't see it anywhere. We don't see it in the state licensing laws, you know, the peace officers' standards rules. We don't see it there. We don't see it in the employer's rules. And goodness knows, state, when you haven't fired troopers who've engaged in sexual misconduct in the past, you haven't demonstrated that policy through your actions. We don't find a public policy that prohibits reinstatement, prohibits the use of progressive discipline in these sorts of cases. This decision from the court is pretty standard. I think pretty much with the exception of Connecticut, that goes a different direction, you can expect to see courts evaluating the public policy doctrine on the basis of whether the order to reinstate a terminated employee violates public policy. The courts don't look at the conduct so much and whether or not the conduct of the employee violates public policy. I mean, if you think about it, pretty much in any termination case where the employee says, I did it, but I shouldn't be fired for this reason. That statement, I did it, means the employee is admitting violating some public policy. The question rather is, does the order of reinstatement violate public policy? In other words, does the public policy command termination and nothing but termination? And that's a rare public policy that you can find. I want to end this month with another reminder to employers, and this comes out of a case from Oregon, my home state of Oregon. We don't tend to use many Oregon cases on this podcast. The litigation doesn't usually get to this level. The reminder's a good one, though. You know, we've got this panoply of federal laws that apply in the employment situation, the ADA, the FMLA, I've talked about those too. Notably, of course, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FLSA, which calls for minimum wage and hour standards. So there's all that basket of obligations that an employer has in any given employment situation. Well, there are other baskets as well. There may be state laws that impose higher requirements on an employer than a federal law would. And of course, there's collective bargaining agreements. You know, that's another basket. And collective bargaining agreements, well, pretty much all have requirements that are greater than federal law. There wouldn't be much use for a collective bargaining agreement that only stated the minimum that was required under a federal law. I mean, all employees would be getting the minimum wage if that was the case. So employers have these various baskets of obligations, and the underlying principle that is worth reminding everybody about, probably can't remind everybody of this too much, is that the employer has to comply with the greatest grant of rights to employees, wherever that might be. That might be a law or a statute in the federal basket or the state basket or the collective bargaining agreement. It might even be under a local ordinance, a city ordinance or charter provision or county charter provision, whatever it might be. Wherever that greatest grant of rights to employees is, the employer has to comply with that. Now, this Oregon case is it's kind of a twist in the sense that the FLSA is only indirectly involved, but it's still a good illustration of this principle. This involves firefighters and the city of Grants Pass, Oregon. And the collective bargaining agreement covering firefighters, it's Local 3564, the IAFF, the collective bargaining agreement is silent on a key issue. And the key issue is whether paid leave taken by the employee counts as hours worked towards the overtime threshold. So in other words, if a firefighter takes, let's make this an 8-hour firefighter, someone maybe doing inspections or whatever. If a firefighter takes 8 hours off on Monday, do those 8 hours count towards the employee's, firefighter's weekly or work period, whatever it might be, overtime threshold? Now, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, we know that paid leave doesn't count towards the overtime threshold. You take that Monday off on sick leave or vacation time, and you come in and work on Saturday, that work under the FLSA isn't overtime because Monday's 8 hours doesn't count. So the 8 hours you're working on Saturday under the FLSA, 8 hours is straight time. Now, this collective bargaining agreement is silent on the issue. So what we have, at least when we're looking at two out of the three most important baskets in this case, we have the FLSA allowing the employer not to count paid leave towards the overtime threshold, and we have the contract being silent on the issue. What's the problem? The problem is there's a state statute here. If you're counting, it's section 652.080 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. It's one that's written just for firefighters. You can only imagine the lobbying effort in the state capitol when this thing got passed. It's written only for firefighters, and it says authorized vacation and sick leave time shall be considered as time on regular duty. The City of Grants Pass, relying on its contract, has not been including paid leave as counting towards the overtime threshold. Local 3564 then petitions the state agency that administers the collective bargaining law. It's known as the Bureau of Labor and Industries in Oregon, and says, look, we want a ruling that the city has to comply with this wage and hour law, with this firefighter specific law. The city's response is, look, what do you mean comply with that law? We have a collective bargaining agreement. It's negotiated under another state law, state collective bargaining law, that creates a comprehensive structure under which public employee unions can negotiate terms of employment. The collective bargaining law supersedes the requirements of this wage and hour statute. And that's the dispute that ends up in the Oregon Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals starts its opinion noting that, or describing the city's argument as novel. Let me tell you, having been there, done that, unfortunately, when a court starts off its opinion describing your argument as novel, are things going to end well for you? Of course not. And that's what happens here. The court says the city has to comply with the wage and hour law. But what about the city's argument about the collective bargaining law superseding the wage and hour law? The court says there's nothing in the text of the collective bargaining law that implies that the legislature intended to create a collective bargaining exception to the wage and hour statute. Typically, when the legislature wants to create an exception, it does so explicitly. Here, the law does not provide that the parties can bargain to exempt themselves from the explicit statutory requirement that for firefighters, you have to count paid leave as hours worked. Court concludes by finding the overtime entitlement under the statute is distinct and separate from the general bargaining provisions and should be read as a discrete statutory directive that collective bargaining agreements for firefighters must follow. So, once again, general principle. This is just a reminder of the general principle. Employers have got to figure out all of the laws that apply to a given situation, and they have to comply with wherever the greatest grant of rights to employees might be. Otherwise, they'll get into trouble like the City of Grants Pass got into trouble. Well, that's it for this month. I've gone about an hour, which is perhaps a little bit too long. I wish I could tell you we had an answer on that fair share case. Commentators are describing it as the biggest labor case that the Supreme Court has decided in decades. We may well, depending on when that opinion comes out, we may put out a podcast, just a one-issue podcast, on the fair share decision once I've had an opportunity to look at it and try to guess what it means for everybody in the public sector. And even if we don't, I'll surely cover it in our July podcast. So with that, enjoy the start of summer. It's gorgeous out here in Oregon, sunny and 80 degrees. We don't have that happen very often this time of year. And hope to see you next month for First Thursday.